We're talking about the Tokyo Games and a new era for women Olympic athletes. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Of the roughly 11,000 athletes competing in the Games, nearly 49% are women. That's from the International Olympic Committee, claiming that this is the first gender-balanced Games in history. Women are competing in record numbers. They're shattering stereotypes and world records. That's you, Sydney McLaughlin, on the track. To be honest, I'm not getting any sleep as I stay glued to primetime coverage well past my morning show bedtime. Have you been watching the women's competitions? What's captured your attention? 800-642-1234. Philip Hirsch has covered 19 Olympics. He's a former Olympic sports writer for the Chicago Tribune for more than 30 years. Phil, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Olympics.
Thank you very much. It's been a strange Olympics, but an interesting one.
Yeah, you know, these games in a pandemic must feel very different than ones you've covered in the past. And yet, you know, for me on my couch, not really at all. The competition is every bit as thrilling. How do you think the empty stadiums and the pandemic have affected these athletes?
Well, some of the effects may have been prior to the Olympics with interrupted training and all sorts of other things for athletes around the world. You know, what's gone on in Tokyo, and I've been watching it from the couch as well for the first time in a long time, what's gone on in Tokyo has been the performances have been really quite excellent and you know, and world record-breaking in some cases. So it's hard to determine exactly what the empty stadium situation has meant. I mean, you had an incredible bronze medal soccer match that the United States women won 4-3.
Spoiler alert if people haven't watched.
But I'm sorry. They were ahead 4-1 and came back, and Australia came back on them. The crowd in that stadium would have gone crazy,
sure.
Needless to say. But the fact that these games are going on still surprises me, actually. And we won't know, certainly, until another couple of weeks, what the impact of having them is on the citizenry of Japan. You know, the precautions that they've taken within the quote-unquote Olympic bubble have produced a very, very low number of COVID cases, or at least reported COVID cases. But what in the general populace, the COVID numbers in Tokyo are higher than they ever have been. Mm. So there appears to be a feeling that if the Olympics are going on, we can go out and party too. So it's going to be a long time before we can come up with an accurate summation of the impact of these Olympics. But certainly the sports competition has been good. And for those of us watching from at home, it's been very diverting.
Well, I want to get your take on a new rule by the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, allowing athletes to express their views on the field of play before competition or during the introduction of athletes. The women's soccer team took knees in a gesture to end racism. What are your thoughts on this new rule?
I wish that, you know, I'm kind of conflicted about part of it. I think that they should have probably gone a little bit further. The problem is, you know, if you are in a medal ceremony and the other two people on the podium don't want to have that medal ceremony interrupted or overshadowed by a gesture of you know, good trouble, as John Lewis would have said, you know, you have to respect the wishes of others as well. And yet I think that in limiting at this time in the world, but again, certainly in the United States, limiting the ability to express support for causes and to express disgust with the behavior of some people is not a particularly wise move.
Hmm. I want to look at pregnancy and postpartum athletes also advocating in these Olympics, totally captivated by sprinter Allison Felix. How has Allison changed the dynamics around parenthood and being an athlete?
Well, Allison, from the time that she called out Nike for trying to cut her contract having cut her contract because she was pregnant, Allison has affected dramatic change. I've known her since she was a 17-year-old kid heading to the 2003 World Championships, and she's one of the most impressive people in sport that I've come in contact with. Just a genuinely good person. And she seemed to me to be sort of an unlikely activist because Allison was a very quiet, thoughtful, but not terribly outgoing person. And for her to have taken on that role is is actually remarkable, and it's also very, very important for women in sport. I mean, Nike eventually went back on its policy and is now no longer cutting its track athletes' contracts if they become pregnant. So what she's done is incredibly important for female athletes, particularly female athletes trying to get support to continue their working careers after they get pregnant and bear a child.
What a story, too, to have Allyson Felix and Quinara Hayes, both proud parents, a little ones, both competing in the 400-meter final.
I mean, it was a great, obviously a great scene at the U.S. Olympic trials with the two little two-year-olds out there and their moms. It's a great, you know, it's just another statement as soon as we removed restrictions from what women can do, women are doing amazing things. I mean, today in track and field, and I'm going to give you another spoiler here, the United States has won 5 gold medals in track and field, which is actually a very low number. 4 of the 5 have come from women, including today Katie Najat in the pole vault. So it's, again, you know, in the last Olympic Games in Rio, the women of the U.S. team basically completely outshone the men. Not that there weren't some good men's performances, but gender equality in the sense of number of events and number of female competitors has come to the Olympic Games, women are taking, particularly in the United States, women are taking full advantage of these new opportunities.
If you're just joining us, we're in the home stretch of the Olympics and talking about the new stars and old stars on the horizon here with Phil Hirsch, former reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covered the Olympics more than 30 years. You can join in. What women's Olympic sports are you still looking forward to seeing in these games? Did you watch Sydney McLaughlin break her own world record in track and win another gold medal? 800-642-1234. Phil, what did you make of that? You know, Sydney McLaughlin, very calm after winning, no screaming, no jumping around. And she said, too many emotions that you have, no emotions.
That's sort of Sydney McLaughlin's personality. Mm-hmm. And the amazing competitive rivalry, it's not a rivalry in any sense of antagonism, just a great competitive rivalry between her and Dalila Muhammad. As Sydney said, iron makes iron tougher. Iron sharpens iron. I think was exactly the same thing that she said. And these two women have pushed their event to incredibly new levels. I mean, both breaking the world record again. So it's been great for the sport, as it was in the men's 400-meter hurdles, with the rivalry between Carsten Warholm of Norway and Rye Benjamin of the United States, taking that event to places it had never been before.
I was just tickled with Gabby Thomas not expecting to medal at all, and to watch her through the heats and the semis, and she's like, wait, I have to change my mindset. I've got a shot at this. I mean, what an amazing story there.
Well, she, you know, obviously burst out of nowhere when she ran 21:61 in the 200 meters at the Olympic trials in June in Oregon. And the way I looked at it, she had a medal shot. So I was not surprised that she won a medal, but it's very difficult when you get to that final and you've never been there before and you can carry it through. The same way that Arian Knight and the 17-year-old in the men's 200 meters finished fourth, which is he was disappointed because he wanted to win the race, which is what makes a great competitor. But still, that's a remarkable performance for someone who's still going into his senior year in high school.
How about Athing Mo, as we stay on the track, gold in women's 800 meters on Tuesday night? That was really significant as well. Talk about a rising star.
I've never seen someone with that kind of poise at 19 years old. I mean, she, in every one of the rounds and going back to the U.S. trials, she just simply set the standard, and she basically controlled the race from beginning to end with that loping stride and that beautiful upright posture. There's no limit on what she might be able to do. What's going to be interesting now is to see if they put her in the women's 4x4 relay. Which there's been a lot of talk about that. There's also been a lot of talk about putting Sydney McLaughlin on the 4x4 relay. She's a great open 400 runner as well, as is Dalila Muhammad, who ran on the 4x4 relay at the World Championships in 2019. So, the problem is that Hayes and Felix presumably will get two of those places in the final, and then you can't knock one of them out if you put the three M's on, Mo, McLaughlin and Muhammad.
It's just like plentiful. You've got options here. Phil Hirsch, he's covered the Olympics for decades as a former sports writer for the Chicago Tribune. We're looking at women's competition today. Friday in this space, we'll focus on the men's. Have you followed the decorated Katie Ledecky in the pool? What about April Ross and beach volleyball action? Then there's Simone Biles' legacy at these games, and it's shining a light on mental health of athletes and the importance of prioritizing it. Join in, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Phil Hirsch here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about women athletes at the Summer Games on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The International Olympic Committee is calling attention to the fact that gender parity has increased with these games, though without mention of non-binary and transgender athletes. A number of countries like the U.S., Australia, Canada, China, they sent teams to Tokyo with more women than men. That's according to the New York Times. What moments stand out so far with women athletes? How is your child taking in the performances and races? Is this a new era for women? Join in, 800-642-1234. Journalist Phil Hirsch has covered 19 Olympics. He's with us for about 9 more minutes. Phil, let's go to the pool with what you saw out of Katie Ledecky winning 2 gold medals, 2 silver medals in Tokyo. What are your thoughts on her performance?
Katie had a second spectacular Olympics, and a lot of people are you know, kind of poo-pooing it because she lost a great race to Ariane Titmus of Australia in the 400 meters, and she didn't have a particularly good 200 meters. Both of those things were kind of expected. She swam a great leg on the 4x2 relay. She won, of course, the 800 and the 1500. You know, it's very, very hard. She's been at this now since the 2012 Olympics, when she won the 800 for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the problem with Katie. She's in that situation where Katie is competing against Katie to a degree because her times are so spectacular. So, you know, I think she had a remarkably good Olympics, and it got. Obviously, when you don't win your first race, people start to say, well, she's not what she used to be. She's a great competitor. She showed that in the 800 and the 1500. Both of those races required her to reach deep within herself. You know, certainly she's the greatest distance swimmer of all time, and you can make a case for her as the greatest, certainly the most decorated and greatest swimmer of all time.
I just had to laugh after one of her swims. I think it was Michelle Tafoya was like, well, was that one your last? And then Katie just looks out at the pool like, well, there's 2024, 2028, you know? This is definitely not the last Olympics for Katie Ledecky.
Well, I mean, one of the things about it is that the next Olympics rolls up now in only 3 years.
Yeah.
And so she can take a little break now. She's finished her undergraduate work at Stanford. I know she's going to go back to spend some time with her parents in Washington area for the first time in a long time. So, I mean, yeah, and she could wind up in 2028. It tends to be that distance swimmers, the amount of training you have to put in to swim those events is so enormous that a lot of times distance swimmers just burn out and they don't want to do that training. Now, whether she could drop down to shorter races or go into other events, that's hard to see. I mean, maybe she could try the 200 individual medley, but the miles, the amount of swimming you have to do to remain competitive in the 8 and the 1500 is pretty amazing.
Taking a moment here to look at the 4x100-meter relay where we had the silver, and I just remember Abby Weitzel just hauling it on that last swim and just coming in like a fingernail behind. It was so close. And, you know, Abby was hanging her head there, and the announcer said there is nothing to hang your head about with that swim. What did you see out of that swim?
Well, I mean, the problem is that you get a lot of people in the United States who think that the United States should win everything. I mean, there are great swimmers in other countries around the world and more, actually. So I thought it was a great swim. I thought that was a terrific performance for them.
How about Lydia Jacoby, the Alaskan swimmer? You know, she was like, she swam with her goggles in her mouth for that mixed, male and female medley race.
you know, she, of course, that had happened to Michael Phelps in the Beijing Olympics, but his goggles didn't drop down to where they were going across her mouth and stopping her from breathing the way that,
yeah,
the way that Lydia's goggles did. No, that was a, you know, you kind of have to deal with what you're given, and that was an unexpected. Apparently, it occurred because she only had one swim cap on, and the goggles then became loose over the top of that one swim cap.
What do you think about mixing the men and the women?
There seems to be a lot of those events seem to be becoming more and more widespread and more popular. It does allow you the tactics. Do you put the men first? Do you put the women first? Which people do you choose? It's obviously occurred in track and field as well. It exists in some winter sports like biathlon, and I'm not sure whether it's going to be in cross-country skiing. But, yeah, I mean, people like the fact that you can get these huge gaps and then somebody closing them down. And so do you put the two men out in front, and do you try to find a way to balance, you know, against the other team's women? It's kind of intriguing tactically.
Yeah. Phil Hirsch with us, former reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covered the Olympics for more than 30 years. As we talk about women's competition today, we'll look at the men tomorrow. Have you been watching the Olympics? What have been your favorite moments? 800-642-1234. Phil, what an incredible roller coaster in women's gymnastic competition. Your thoughts there?
Well, Simone Biles came into the Olympics as clearly the designated star for United States consumption. And it was a tremendous burden on her. As she said, before one of the competitions, or she posted on Instagram, I'm not exactly sure when, it might have been after the team qualifying, that she felt the weight of the world on her shoulders. And then she had wound up dealing with a very problematic issue, which she calls twisties, which occurs in things like dance, occurs in acrobatics, where she was no longer aware of where she was in the air when she was spinning. And gymnastics is an incredibly dangerous sport if you've got full command of everything, let alone if you have no idea where you are in the air. So she did the wisest thing for both herself and in fact for the team in that team competition, because they might not have won any medal at all if she had tried to continue, and even worse, she might have injured herself badly. So she has been dealing with so much as the only still active survivor of the Larry Nassar sexual abuse, sexual harassment scandal, and as the overwhelming poster woman for this Olympics in the United States, and as an athlete who's getting a little older, she was dealing with a tremendous amount, and you could actually begin to see, even at the U.S. Olympic trials, that her performances weren't what we had become accustomed to from Simone Biles, even if she was winning. So Simone Biles comes out of this games as a tremendous winner. She's shown people that vulnerability is not a bad thing I mean, you're better off expressing vulnerability and letting people know that you know, your own mental health is more important than trying to go out there and risk your own long-term physical health on something as transitory as an Olympic medal.
And then Suni Lee's story, you know, one commentator said Suni has lifted the America's Hmong community on her strong shoulders. And just watching her win that individual all-around competition was just absolutely breathtaking.
It was. And you know, if you know what the Hmong community went through in Southeast Asia during and after the Vietnam War, and of course a large number have immigrated to Minneapolis, and they really are a community in every sense of the word. And you know, at this time when there's been so much Asian American hate expressed by mindless people in the United States, it certainly lifted that community. I hope it lifted every American, let alone, you know, not just this one community, but lifted everyone to show what's possible.
Well, I want to touch on April Ross and Alex Kleinman, beach volleyball. What a powerhouse duo. I mean, they absolutely handled Sweden without, you know, batting an eye. What is your take on the setup against Australia?
Yeah, to be perfectly frank, I'm going to probably get some angry responses to this. I think beach volleyball has had its day in the sun.
Really?
So much of it has been shown in the primetime show, and I just wonder, you know, I've kind of lost interest in it. I mean, these are two great athletes, and they're clearly capable of winning a gold medal. But I just wonder, you know, how much interest there is in beach volleyball anymore. It was obviously a big hit when it first came into the game, which I'm trying to remember whether that was Beijing or right before then. But it seems to me that it's been overexposed, and it just doesn't hold the appeal for me that it once did.
Well, Phil, thank you for joining us. We'll catch up with you tomorrow for the men's competition.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too. Keep watching. Phil Hirsch, former reporter for the Chicago Tribune, covered the Olympics for more than 30 years. We will talk to Phil again at this time Friday. Takeaways from the men's competition. Join us for that. Coming up, we look at whether companies are staying committed to investing in equity and inclusion efforts following big promises made during the Black Lives Matter movement against police brutality last year. Did your company make statements or pledges? What is the status now? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're taking stock of how American companies are doing as they promised to fight for racial justice last year. It's a report from the Conference Board on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the wake of George Floyd's murder, many companies pledged large sums of money to address racial inequality. Here's a TV ad from Bank of America making its pledge and laying out the underlying issues that communities of color face.
That's why Bank of America has committed $1 billion over 4 years to address critical gaps in affordable housing, access to health care, employment and job skills, and the resources small businesses need to succeed. We can do more to further advance racial equality and economic opportunity for all.
But have corporations delivered your insights? 800-642-1234. Paul Washington is executive director of the ESG Center at the Conference Board. The ESG Center is a nonprofit think tank focusing on corporate governance, sustainability, and corporate citizenship and philanthropy. Its report is called Corporate Racial Equality Investments 1 Year Later. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be here.
Well, you reached out to dozens of companies and really tried to dig into what is going on surveying these companies. What did you hear from them?
Well, we heard a few things, and I'll just give you a couple of the headlines. I think the main one was that companies are, in fact, making a serious sustained effort to achieve impact with their philanthropic contributions here. You know, why did they do this? Well, 84% of them made these contributions because it's aligned with their company values. They made contributions because it was aligned with their business, and notably because they believed they could have an enduring impact. So this was not just responding to internal or external pressure. This was genuine. And the other thing is, in terms of the length of their commitments, it's not your conventional, you know, 1 year, write a check and move on. Most companies that we've heard from are actually making a sustained effort, a multi-year effort here. And you heard that actually in the Bank of America ad. So I think that's the principal takeaway from this report. Now, there are obviously things that we found that companies can do better going forward. But I think that's the principal headline.
Well, there were, when you talk about internal and external influences, there were huge forces going on, you know, in certainly in the Black Lives Matter movement, post George Floyd, and, you know, all of the protests were over police brutality. And I'm wondering what those influences were doing inside the ranks of these corporations.
It's a great question. So when it came to who pushed for this, for companies to make these financial commitments, and many of them are, you know, you heard B of A's, but, you know, dozens of companies made commitments of over $100 million. And that's a significant amount, especially for an area where they hadn't necessarily focused their resources before. The main drivers were actually the CEO and senior management. They said, we need to be doing something. The next biggest driver was employees, who said, we need to be doing something here. Following that were customers, a little bit of peer pressure. And one thing that wasn't a factor actually were the company's investors. They care about these issues. We've talked to investors who care very much about this, but in the time frame we're talking about, it was really internal pressure from the top, or internal decision making from the top, that said we need to do something here.
And it oftentimes is how top down structures work, where you get those messages from people in power, and then that is how it gets started.
Yes, and that has a good side, right? Because if you've got the support of the CEO and the senior management team, you know, this really has oomph behind it. The other thing, though, that can happen, and this is one of the lessons learned, is sometimes companies got a bit out over their skis in making commitments before they quite knew what they were going to do with it. So one of the recommendations coming out of a report is companies may need to spend a little more time socializing what they plan to do and how they plan to follow through before they make the statements. Because, you know, if it's just the head of communications going in to talk to the CEO, in this case, it was probably virtual, and they come up with an initiative, why it's better to have your philanthropy executives, your general counsel, your CFO, all the other people who might be involved, and maybe if you can consult with some employee resource groups before you make the commitment, so you really have a sense of what is realistic for you to do.
Certainly what is realistic, and you get more buy-in, more people at the table. Can you give a specific example of a situation where a company did get out ahead of itself, or where it didn't turn out in the way that it might expect?
You know, the discussion we had with our companies was in fact under the Chatham House rule. So I can't really give you named examples, but I can tell you that a couple of the things that happened to big companies who did this was related to the language that they used. That in some cases, they forgot to talk about what they were already doing. And they made this seem like this was just directed at Black Lives Matters, and they sort of ignored what they were already doing in the area. The other thing is that sometimes they phrased what they were doing in a way that made other communities, including Asian Americans who are suffering intense discrimination at that stage in the pandemic, feel excluded. So what companies had to do sometimes was to go back and sort of backfill and have conversations with their Asian Pacific employee resource groups to change how they were talking about it, to make it clear to their employees, Black and white and of all other racial and ethnic backgrounds, that what they were doing was really important for everyone at the company. So I think there were instances where the way they phrased this kind of put them in a difficult, position that they had to correct later on.
Paul, how did you decide which corporations to interview for this particular study to target?
Sure. Well, we generally reached out to members who of the conference board and those who have been active in corporate citizenship, because what we were looking for were the practices of generally large leading companies. And we wound up hearing in our survey from nearly 100 companies. But then the thing that really helped was we then had a gathering of about 50, 60 executives from those companies. And it was the combination of the empirical data we got from the survey, plus the discussion of the data, that produced these, I think, really valuable insights. I'll just give you one example, if I might. Mm-hmm. The survey indicated that 60% of the companies found that they had not had any issues yet with their nonprofit grantee organizations, all the people they're going to be giving these hundreds and billions of dollars to. In the room, we heard from executives saying, well, that sounds on the surface like a very good thing, that you're not having any issues with your nonprofit grantees. But in reality, that's a yellow flag, corporate America, because, you know, do you ever think your company doesn't have issues with things? So you really need to have a candid, completely forthright dialogue with your nonprofit grantees to figure out, are they able to handle the money that you're giving them? What are their capacity limitations? What do they really, you know, what are they hearing from the communities that they serve that may not match the grant that you're giving? So one big recommendation coming out of the report is for all of these companies who have made these commitments to engage in that kind of candid dialogue with their nonprofit grantees to make sure that they're fully aligned before the dollars start flowing out the door.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Paul Washington, who is the executive director of the ESG Center at the Conference Board. We're looking at a new report that studies the investments companies made to address equity issues and where they are a year later. With your insights, how do you think corporations are doing in their promises made to fight for racial justice? Are you noticing specific efforts? What stands out to you? Or what is your company doing on this front? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, which inequality or issues of access are businesses working to address? Can you kind of go into that area?
Sure. The money is being spent in a whole range of areas. The largest area is economic inequality and poverty, with about 24% of the dollars going in that direction. Next up, though, is an area that's somewhat new for companies, and that is investing in racial and social justice advocacy organizations. So that's kind of new for a lot of companies. But they're also investing in housing, in education, in access to healthcare, and notably, another new area is criminal justice reform. So you really do see money being spent in a lot of areas that are underlying causes or at least immediate consequences of racial inequality, and in a couple new areas as well. So, but that, you know, that also does raise a challenge for companies right now, which is in the wake of George Floyd's murder, you had most companies making announcements and they're going out on their own. You know, mm-hmm. It's a 2-week turnaround, right? And so they said, okay, here's what company X is doing. Here's our $50 million. Here's our $100 million. Here's this. Well, now that we're in the implementation phase, one of our recommendations is companies should really get together. If you're, you know, in the Milwaukee area or something like that, you know, you should be looking at the other companies headquartered in the area and compare notes and figure out how you can combine your resources to have greater impact.
What was their reaction to small business development or putting resources into BIPOC small businesses?
You know, they did a lot of that. Now, they generally have not done that as much through their philanthropic side, you know, which is where you're just going often giving money away and expect a social return, but not a financial return. But many companies are doing that. I think Wells Fargo, in fact, set up a separate, they took all their PPE money and put it into a foundation fund where it's hundreds of millions of dollars going to support small business, largely minority small businesses or businesses in disadvantaged communities. So there are companies who are doing a lot, but they're doing that when it's aligned with their business. So financial institutions are doing this. You know, you kind of don't expect a, you know, a cosmetics company or something like that to be putting money into sort of venture capital efforts.
Paul Washington leads the ESG Center at the Conference Board as we look at how companies have addressed racial inequality over the past year. How do you think corporations are doing in their promises? Have you noticed specific efforts? Has it changed your perception of certain companies or how you purchase things, how you buy? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Paul Washington here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing a new report from the Conference Board that looked at how companies took a stand last year after the killing of George Floyd and whether they follow through on those investments and pledges to take on racial inequality. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Conference Board, for its report, held a discussion with dozens of corporate citizenship executives. Their survey found the pace of spending over the year reflects the seriousness with which companies are tackling this issue. Did your company make commitments to anti-racism efforts? What did it say? What is being done? Join in 800-642-1234. Paul Washington leads the ESG Center at the Conference Board, is with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Bill now in Sun Prairie. Bill, your thoughts.
I've been an educator for 26 years, and when Floyd was murdered, everybody wanted to do something, and rightfully so. However, it just writhes me that these corporations didn't do research into what the BLM corporation actually is in a socialist organization. And they needed to invest in education because that's where the only disparity is. Because kids will prosper given a culture of positive reinforcement in education, irregardless of their background, starting point, skin color, but it is the parents and the culture around these kids that devalues education and that sets these kids behind, nothing to do with race or color or poverty.
Bill, thank you. I want to get Paul's reaction here on what the executives had to say about education.
Sure. That was, in fact, one of the leading areas. It was 24% of the funds went to poverty and economic inequality, 21% went to education. So it was, in fact, the number two area. You know, when companies give money to education, though, it's a challenge because the dollars they're spending there are often drops in a bucket, right? And we've seen corporations go in with great fanfare in some cities and not achieve as much as they might. So it clearly is an area of focus, but it's also when the company is trying to consider where they can have the most impact, it's a tricky area for them to invest in, but it's one where they're putting their dollars right now or are planning to put their dollars.
How would you describe the level of involvement employees have had when it comes to these companies' commitment to racial equality? What is the role of the rank and file employees?
It's a terrific question. So it comes across as it does in the broader question of how companies respond to social issues. So they are often the ones who are bringing issues to management's attention. Sometimes, it's not necessarily in this instance, but a single letter to the CEO or a member of senior management can spark a company's taking a stand on social issues. The second thing that they're doing here is that they're employee resource groups. We've seen at companies who have resource groups based around perhaps ethnicity or around interest, that those resource groups are absolutely critical in helping to shape the company's response, especially as they move into the implementation phase. And then the third thing that's happening is that the employees are actively involved in carrying out the company's efforts, whether through employee volunteering or in some cases, they are actually directing where the money goes, particularly to community organizations. There are some companies who have said, you know what, local employees, here's a pot of money that's available to you. You know your community really well. Help us find the right organizations to give money to. Now, the company still vets those organizations and so forth, but it's really interesting. So companies play an absolutely central role in companies' responses to social issues. The other thing that they do is they help to keep it real. They are a gut check because if your employees don't buy what you're saying and what you're doing, that's a very big signal that you've got some work to do before you go out there and make a big public splash.
As you look at these nonprofit community organizations and their partnerships with these very large, perhaps multinational corporations, how do you see those relationships, and what can happen along the way when you have such a contrast there?
Right. And we recently put out another report on how companies can make an enduring difference in American cities. We looked at Newark, Baltimore, Los Angeles, and Detroit. And I think the number one lesson that came out of the discussion was that companies, and companies have been making this shift, but companies cannot show up with their check and with their programmatic ideas in hand and say, this is what we want to accomplish. Here's our RFP, and we want you all nonprofits to fill out a form so you can get this these lovely dollars, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the way to do it. That really companies, if they want to make a lasting difference, need to listen in order to lead. And so it's having a conversation with the local community organizations about what the community's issues are, what the organization's issues are, and then sitting down with them and collectively defining what the objectives are, what resources are needed to achieve it, what are realistic outcomes, and then in some cases, committing to multi-year funding. It may have an initial year where you're just testing it out, but, you know, have the idea that we're going to be in this for a while. And I think that listening in order to lead is a key aspect for companies these days.
We're talking with Paul Washington, who leads the ESG Center at the Conference Board, as we discuss a new report that looked at whether companies are staying true to addressing racial inequities following commitments last year. Paul, you know, as you look at the realistic outcomes, as you say, and how companies are measuring outcomes or where they are at in this process and their commitments, how do they make those measurements?
Well, that's a great question, because where companies are right now is this past year, and it shows the seriousness of their effort, they've really been focusing on building their own capabilities. Not a lot of dollars have gone out the door yet. So companies have met with racial equality experts. They've assessed where they went wrong in the past. They've built internal consensus. They've built relationships with outside nonprofit partners. So they're still in the capability building phase. So a lot of dollars have not yet gone out the door. So ways to measure your impact is not just on the dollars spent, not just on the number of people served, but on what measurable difference it made in the community or in society. And that's the main focus. And it's also a big challenge. But one way to do that, again, is to have a conversation both with your nonprofit partners and with government agencies to say, what are the metrics that we should be using to determine success here?
Paul, thank you for joining us.
I'm really delighted. Thank you so much for having a conversation, and I really appreciate your thoughtful approach to this topic.
Paul Washington is Executive Director of the ESG Center at the Conference Board. Find a link to the report at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, we talk with an oceanographer and a marine biologist about her new memoir, Exploring Light and Life in the Deep Sea. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.